This is the legendary Tom DeFalco, and I hope you'll join me in the Cave of Solitude.
So welcome back, everybody, to the Cave of Solitude. This week, we have a very special guest coming on to the show. In this day and age, we often hear the term comic book legend used very loosely and I would say irresponsibly, but that is not the case with today's guest. Perhaps you know him from being the writer and co-conspirator on titles with Ron Frenz on The Amazing Spider-Man and The Mighty Thor, and they also together created the beloved Spider-Girl. Or maybe you know him for his tenure on the Fantastic Four or his many contributions as editor and editor-in-chief for Marvel Comics. Today's guest is none other than the legend, Tom DeFalco. Tom, thank you for being on the show.
Thank you for having me, Eric.
So I want to start off not necessarily going into deep dive of your history just yet. We'll get there eventually. But I want to talk about some of the things you've recently worked on that kind of go back in time to your origin in comics, and that's Archie Comics. You recently did a miniseries of Reggie and Me. How did that collaboration come about? Because I was recommended it from a fellow podcaster, Adam Chapman, and I absolutely loved it. So how did it all come together for you to get back into Archie Comics and doing Reggie and Me?
Well, I used to work at Archie Comics at the very beginning of my career, and my immediate supervisor was a gentleman by the name of Victor Gorelick. He's currently, I don't know what his title is at Archie Comics, but he's still there. I think he's either the editor-in-chief or the creative director or something like that. Basically, he's the guy who knows everything there is to know about Archie Comics. And Victor is the man who pretty well taught me everything I know. Not quite everything he knows, so I have to keep checking back in with Victor so I can learn more. At a certain point, Archie asked me if I'd be interested in doing a limited series, and they suggested Reggie and Me, and I said, okay. And they said, we think the Me is his dog.
Okay.
And I thought, oh, that's an intriguing idea. So I kept thinking about it, and then the story, came into being, and I proposed it to them, and they were thrilled by the idea of the dog being the narrator, because it never occurred to them that the dog would actually narrate the series. And I thought, yeah, come on, if you're going to do a series about Reggie, you have to have a sympathetic narrator. Who would be more sympathetic than his dog? Because if you've ever had a dog, they love us unconditionally.
Yeah, and that's what I loved immediately about the story, because I read the first series that Mark Waid had done about Archie, and then I enjoyed it, but I didn't dive deeper into the entire universe that they were relaunching. But when I started reading the Reggie and Me and seeing that the Me was actually the dog, owning a dog myself, I could totally relate, and it I was totally sold on it. Are you a dog owner yourself? Did it come easy to write from the perspective of a dog?
No, I seem to be a cat guy these days.
Okay.
I always thought of myself as a dog person, but then I got exposed to some cats and they stole my heart.
Oh, okay. But in regards to Vader, the dog that's featured in Reggie and Me, how did you, was it already chosen or decided that the dog was a dachshund, or were there those type of things that you kind of came together with?
I believe Archie gave me the idea that he was a dachshund and gave me his name. And then I just went from there.
Did you feel that writing it from a dog's perspective, especially for someone who's kind of considered the villain of the Archie world, would give him something to be the reader to be sympathetic in regards to Reggie?
No, absolutely. I wanted it to be sympathetic. even when Wrenching is doing his slimiest things, the dog is making excuses for him. You know, and explaining everything from you know, Reggie's point of view.
Yeah, no.
You know, no villain thinks of themselves as a villain. You know, they all want to do, they all see things from their perspective. I always look at, you know, Dr. Doom, who, you know, he wanted to bring world peace and hunger and war and crime. Mm-hmm. And all he asked was one little thing in exchange for that. The total blind obedience.
Right.
You know, so as far as he was concerned, it was, you know, it was a good deal for people.
Right. And whenever you look at Dr. Doom and the people of Latveria, they, a lot of times you got that mixed sense of the civilians there are actually happy under his rule because he takes good care of them. But like you said, they have to have that undying obedience, blind obedience.
Yes, yes. You know, some people in Latveria, you know, they love being there, and other people were just terrified.
Right. So in regards to, for me, reading it now, I, for the first time, looked at Reggie as somebody who I really understood, and I almost kind of rooted for him to not necessarily win or be a slime ball, but through the eyes of Vader, I saw the good qualities of Reggie, just for the fact that he rescued a dog. It touched my heart.
Yeah, even though he did it for a slimy reason.
Right. From the dog's perspective, you're always like, yeah, he rescued me. He's my best friend. Great book. I really enjoyed it. Highly recommend it to the listeners to check that book out.
Well, thank you very much. I really enjoyed that. I just had a fun time with it.
Any plans of going back to do some more in regards to that series?
Not at the present. I'm always open to doing more work for Archie Comics. You know, right now we have no plans to do any more Reggie and Me.
Right.
Or actually, right now I have no plans to do anything at Archie.
Gotcha. So let's take it back to the beginning just a little bit. So if my sources are correct, which are Wikipedia, so if I'm wrong, please correct me. You grew up in New York City in the 50s and 60s?
More Queens and Long Island.
Queens and Long
Island. Than actual New York City.
Okay. So being close enough to the city, I got to ask you, were you a Mets or Yankees fan?
I was a Mets fan.
Okay.
I basically lived a cursed existence. I grew up, you know, Mets in a Yankee town and Jets in a Giants town.
Right.
And both my teams for most of the time I was following, were losers and bums.
Oh.
The Mets, a bunch of years ago, they did something which I thought was reprehensible. So I kind of erased them out of my existence. I haven't seen a game in many a year. But I'm still a loyal Jets fan. And, we don't have a winning season, you know, in the horizon. I'm just talking about a winning season. Forget about playoffs or anything like that.
Well, growing up in Toronto, I can totally relate because we've got the Toronto Maple Leafs who everybody adores and loves, but they haven't given us much to cheer for in the last 50 years. So, cursed existence, we share that in common in regards to our sports teams.
What are you going to do?
What are you gonna...
When you hook onto a team, you hook onto a
That's
team.
That's it.
You know, so good and bad, I'm just waiting for the good.
That's it. It'll come. Did you have a favorite baseball player growing up?
As a little kid, Mickey Mantle was, you know, Mickey Mantle, Gil Hodges, those were the guys that I looked up to.
So even though they played for the other team, Mickey Mantle was still the man for you?
Yeah, you know, That's when I was a little kid. He was the man.
He was, yeah. Home run with one arm, right? You have to, I got a soft spot for the Yankees just because of Mickey Mantle myself. So I completely understand. So you didn't grow up directly in New York City, Queens, Long Island, you say, but as an adult working for Marvel Comics, you were naturally in the city quite frequently. Am I safe to assume that?
When I worked for Archie Comics, I commuted into the city. And when I ended up working on the editorial staff of Marvel, again, I commuted into the city.
Okay. So I asked that question to ask this one. In New York City, where can you find the best pizza?
Where can you find the best pizza in New York City? I'm going to guess Joe's Pizza in the Village.
Joe, okay, next time.
In New York City, you really have to go out of your way to find a bad slice of pizza.
That's true.
Almost any street corner has a pizza shop that has, at the very least, mm-hmm. decent pizza.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it is so much better than you would get in all the other, places in the world. There are basically three places to get good pizza. New York City, San Francisco, and Boston.
Okay. And does New York take the cake out of all of those three places for you?
Oh, yeah, no question.
Okay. How about pizza?
San Francisco is close.
Okay.
Because they make a sourdough pizza, which is just terrific.
So next time I'm in New York City, I got to make sure that I'm going to try to find Joe's Pizza. Is it still there?
Yes. Yep. They got. I think they have two locations.
Okay. Awesome. So again, growing up in the '60s, you got to see the renaissance of some fantastic music. Were you a Beatles or Rolling Stones fan?
More Beatles, but I was never that much into music.
Okay.
The kind of music that I went, I was more of a Bob Dylan, Simon Garfunkel kind of guy. Loving Spoonful.
Okay.
But not a big music guy. I was a big reader.
Right, right. And that's leading up to the next question. What everybody wants to know, was Tom DeFalco Marvel or DC fan as a kid?
When I first started reading comics, Marvel was just producing those, horror comic books. I call them horror comic books, the monster books, the Tales of Suspense, Journey into Mystery, that sort of stuff, and Westerns. And I read some of those, but, I was a DC guy, The Flash, Green Lantern, The Atom, that sort of stuff. And at a certain point, I was starting to outgrow comics. They were just, they weren't as intriguing me as much as the books were. I was reading Edgar Rice Burroughs and Robert E. Howard and, all sorts of science fiction authors and stuff like that. So I was kind of outgrowing comics. And then one day I walked into a candy store that had a spinner rack, and they had two issues of a comic called Fantastic Four, mm-hmm. which when I first saw the title, I just assumed it meant there were four stories in the book. But then I recognized the Human Torch on the two of the covers and said, oh, I guess this is some team. So I picked up the two issues. They were Fantastic Four 3 and 4.
Oh, wow.
And, I read those two comics, and they just blew my mind. I just, there I was at the ripe old age of 10 or 11, the perfect time for that stuff. And They just grabbed me by the throat, and from then on, I was mainly a Marvel guy.
Wow! But to and get into the Fantastic Four on the ground floor like that. Like, what an amazing two issues to be able to find in the spinner rack at that time. Do you still have them?
You know, I a couple of years ago, we had this thing here called Hurricane Sandy.
Right.
Which, you know, kind of destroyed my house and stuff. And I lost a lot of my comics at that point, and then a lot of them I had to sell to, repair the damage, and I didn't really have a place for them. So I had to get rid of a lot of my early comics.
Oh, I'm sorry to hear that. I didn't mean to ask such a heartbreaking question.
I still have my masterwork, so I can still read those stories. And, I don't have to own, the original comics.
Right.
Just having access to the stories is good enough for me.
So were the Fantastic Four your favorite book, or did you have a favorite character as a kid growing up when you got into Marvel Comics and discovered this connected universe?
I love the Fantastic Four. When Spider-Man came in, Spider-Man just overwhelmed me. I love Thor, the Hulk, Ant-Man always got to me. Daredevil, I'd say that my two favorite characters growing up were probably Spider-Man and Captain America.
Okay. What was it about those two particularly that appealed to you?
Spider-Man, I just identified very closely with the character. Mm-hmm. This was a guy who, was constantly second-guessing himself and could see the dark cloud behind every, silver lining. And Captain America... I just love the fact that he symbolized to me what was the spirit of America, the can-do spirit, that mm-hmm. he would always find a way, to solve any problem.
Mm-hmm.
I remember, I think it was in Avengers 4 where they first introduced him. Mm-hmm. At some point, the Submariner grabs him by the ankle and is holding him upside down, about to dash him against these boulders. And Captain America's thinking, he's bigger, stronger, and far more powerful than me, but I'll find a way to beat him.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wow. if Submariner had me by the ankle upside down, I'd be thinking, holy shit, I'm dead.
Right. So... eventually getting a chance to work for Marvel Comics. Did you know that early on that you wanted to be a comic book writer or just a writer in general?
I thought of myself growing up just to become a writer in general.
Okay.
And I think this is a very important thing that, anybody in your audience who wants to write, be a writer first and a guy who does comics, a guy or gal who does comics second.
Right.
Let that be one of the quivers in your, or one of the arrows in your quiver. But don't just focus on one medium. It is a terrible, terrible mistake.
Mm-hmm.
As I was growing up, I tried my hand, mainly short stories and that sort of stuff because I couldn't draw. When I finally went to college, I worked in a PR office. I wrote press releases. I worked for a local newspaper. I did reviews. I did, anything I could, write. I did some short stories, which, unbelievably, I sold it, back in those days. I was just doing all sorts of writing. I was thinking that I was mainly focused on being a prose writer.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if it would be, fiction or working for a newspaper or what the heck it would be. I didn't really think in terms of comics.
Mm-hmm.
I did work on a comic strip while I was in college, and I enjoyed that a lot. And after I graduated, I noticed that the comic book industry had changed a lot. When I was growing up, they had Stan Lee was writing almost all the comic books at Marvel, and Bob Kaniger was writing all the good comic books at DC.
Right.
And you know, while I was away at school and stuff like that, Roy Thomas and Denny O'Neill and all these other guys came in.
Mm-hmm.
I thought, well, you know, I guess there's opportunities for other people to do some writing. Not that I put myself in a class with Denny O'Neill or Roy Thomas or Jerry or any of those guys. They're still, you know, I look at those guys as really the giants of the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, I, you know, decided to take my shot and see if I could, you know, get a job in one of the comic book companies. So I did it in the worst way possible. I sent a resume out to the different comic book companies, and to my surprise, I heard back from Archie, and they offered me a job.
Wow. And how long were you there with working for Archie Comics?
About 7 or 8 years.
Oh, okay. So you put in a good amount of time.
I was there for a while. Like I said, they basically trained me. I started in their production department, which would be like the equivalent of Marvel's bullpen,
mm-hmm.
and basically learn the industry from the ground up. And after a couple of years, I started to work for them part time. I would work there, I think I cut it down to working there 3 days a week. I'd come into the office, and then every 2 days, I'd do my writing.
So when you eventually transitioned to working for Marvel Comics, what are some of the things that you take with you from Archer? What's the transition like from doing a book like that, where now you're dealing in a superhero universe with continuity to consider and all those type of things?
Well, I'll tell you how I got to the superhero things. I met Paul Levitz and then eventually Joe Orlando, and started to do some commercial comics with them, and then some humor comic books with them. And then at one point, Joe asked me if I had any interest in doing superhero stuff. And I said, I don't know, Joe. That stuff looks so hard. And he said to me, wait a minute, are you kidding me? He said, you know, you need to be able to do characterization. He says, you can do characterization.
Right.
He says, you need to be able to do a plot. You can do a plot.
Yeah.
He said, but here's the kicker. It doesn't have to be funny. Because you're doing half the work, and they pay you the same rate.
There you go.
And I thought, wait a minute, half the work, and you get paid the same amount of money? And I thought, it doesn't have to be funny. and he said, yeah, if you want to throw some jokes in. But, you know, you don't have to worry about making it funny, because making it funny is at least half the job.
Right, right.
And I thought, well, half the job, that's like 60%, 70% of the job. And I thought, oh, hey, this is, you know, let me try that stuff. So I just kind of transitioned in there. And all the things I'd learned about characterization and plot and, you know, and everything else from Archie, I just, you know, brought over. Because story structure, story construction is the same whether you're writing an Archie story or whether you're writing a comic book story or a prose short story or a prose novel or a teleplay, you know, or, you know, an episode of whatever TV show that you're working on. It's all plot structure is plot structure.
Right. And then you get a title eventually like Spider-Man where you got to add the humor all over again. So did you feel like you were doing all the work again with writing a character who was humorous all the time?
But by that point, I was, you know, I was afraid of other things.
Right.
I at one point I started to write for Marvel, and they offered me, you know, eventually offered me an exclusive writing contract. And then at a certain point, Jim Shooter was reorganizing the editorial department, and he asked me if I'd like to come on staff as an editor. And I hadn't been, you know, I didn't have a full-time job for years before that. Mm-hmm. I was used to being a freelancer, and I said to him, Jim, I'm really not sure I'm up for that anymore. You know, I like being a full-time writer. They said, well, could you come out and help me for about 6 months, just till I get everything straightened out? And I said, yeah, I could do 6 months. 6 months ended up to be closer to 20 years. But so I came on temporarily, and then to my surprise, one of the titles that he gave me was the Spider-Man titles.
Yeah. And at that time, it was just two books, right? It was Spectacular Spider-Man and Amazing Spider-Man.
And Marvel Team-Up.
Marvel Team-Up, that's right. Okay.
And I was the first time all three titles were under one editor.
Okay.
And I remember saying, I went to him and I said, Jim, you know, I'm the new guy. Why are you giving me, you know, Marvel's most important title? Because as far as I was concerned, Spider-Man was Marvel's most important title. And he said, don't worry about it. It's just like Archie, except with superpowers. Huh. And I thought about it and said, yeah, you know, he's right.
It's true. I never thought of it that way, but you're right. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And so I edited Archie for a while. I edited the Spider-Man titles for a while and ghostwrote a bunch of other things, had a ball editing. And then, you know, at a certain point, they promoted me. And they took my titles away, for which I never forgave them. Roger Stern was writing Amazing Spider-Man at the time. Mm-hmm. And the new editor of Spider-Man was a gentleman by the name of Danny Fingula. And Danny came in to me, and I was the executive editor. And one of my jobs was to keep track of our freelancers and who was working on what. And Danny came to me and he said, Roger Stern is going to leave Spider-Man. He wants to go write the Avengers. And I said, oh, man, that's going to be a hard, you know, a hard slot to fill. He says, yeah, I'm going to need a writer. And I said, okay. And I pulled off my list of all of our writers. And I looked down at the list and I started rattling off names of guys who I thought would be good on Spider-Man.
Who are some of those people you thought would have been good to follow up on Roger Stern's run?
You know, it's so many years. It's hard to remember. I know Archie Goodwin was one of the guys I suggested. Mark DeMattis. I'm not sure who else I suggested at that time.
Both good picks. So.
Anyway, I looked up and I realized, you know, Danny had this goofy expression on his face. and I said, you're not taking notes. He says, no, I already know who I want. And I said, if you know who you want, why are you wasting my time? He says, because you're the guy I want. And I said, are you kidding me? Only an idiot is going to follow Roger Stern. And he says, well, you're not that bright. I think you can do it. I was convinced that I couldn't write Peter Parker's dialogue. And I was just afraid that I wouldn't get the voice right and that sort of stuff. But I agreed to script it for a while. And I said, Roger plotted a couple of issues, which he doesn't want to script. And I said, okay, I'll script those. And if I screw it up, you can replace me right away.
Right.
And I, you know, took the assignment fully prepared to get fired. They had another temporary guy, Ron Frenz, was filling in for J.R. Jr.
Right.
Who was, he was going to get the X-Men on time. So J.R. Decided that, he was going to, you know, give up a couple of issues. So I got to work with this guy, Ron French, who I knew already. I had hired him for Marvel Team Up when I was an editor. I knew Ron. I liked Ron. He and I had the same kind of sensibilities. And he and I started working together and eventually formed a partnership, which has lasted 30-some-odd years.
Yeah, I can't think of another writer-artist who are known to have worked together as much and successfully as you guys have. You guys made quite the team.
Listen, for the most part at this stage of the game, I think my comic book days are over. Mm-hmm. But if they weren't, or the way to guarantee that they wouldn't be is to offer me any assignment with Ron French. Because I love the guy. I love working with the guy. He is just there aren't enough superlative adjectives for me to praise Ron. Ron is just, you know, the absolute best, and he's a good friend. He's a great person, and just probably the best visual storyteller in this industry today.
Wow. It's so nice to, whenever I hear both of you guys on different shows and podcasts, you always really sing each other's praises. There's the mutual respect between you guys is a great thing that you oftentimes don't hear enough of when artists, and a lot of times when we didn't live in the same city, they just sent me the plot, they sent me the script, and I drew it. We talked on the phone maybe once or twice, but you guys really have a creative bond and a true friendship, and it comes through in the work. So that's great. I love hearing you guys always sing each other's praises, giving each other the credit for good ideas.
Well, I can tell you, you know, Ron and I, we talk out the stories and that sort of stuff. I've always maintained that all the good ideas, all the ideas that you personally like, Ron came up with. Mm-hmm. I came up with all the ones you didn't like.
And he says the opposite. He says the same thing you're saying. So you go from editing the book to writing it. What are some of the... for the listeners who may not understand how important an editor is to a particular title, what were some of the things you had to do when you overlooked what Roger was writing at the time? Roger Stern, that is.
Well, when you're the editor of a comic book, you're kind of like the director of a movie.
Okay.
You have to put all the creative people together, and you have to keep them all working and keep them all focused. The purpose of the editor is to look at the character long term and think about what is good for this character long term. Where the writer, his purpose is very short term. I want to work on this one story and I want to make this story great. But the editor has to look and say, wait a minute. You can have this one great story, but it ruins or hurts the character. Mm-hmm. And also the editor has to make sure that the writer and the penciler are working, you know, together and not fighting each other.
Right.
Because sometimes egos get in the way and, you know, a writer has one idea, a penciler has another idea on how to handle the scene, and they end up, you know, straining against each other.
Right.
And then the main thing is, you know, an editor's job is to get that book out on time. Now, you know, these days, getting the book out on time isn't as important as it was in my day, because in my day we had the newsstand, and
right.
If you didn't get the book out on time, you didn't get distributed on the newsstand, which meant, you know, the company lost money on that title.
Yeah. So there was much more, did you feel the pressure much more back then of the bottom line having to be the main focus for you as an editor? Even though you wanted the story and the artist and everything, the writer to be collaborating well, at the end of the day, you really had to make sure the bottom line was the bottom line.
Well, yes and no. You wanted the book to sell, and you wanted the book to sell well.
Right.
But deep in all of our hearts was the notion that quality sells. So if you did a really terrific story, a really exciting story, or a fun goofball story that would appeal to the readers, and you had a nice cover on it that would basically say, you know, your life will be incomplete forever unless you buy me.
Mm-hmm.
you know, if you did real quality work, it would sell. And we all believe that at all times. So, you know, our main focus was to do the best story we could because we believed, you know, naively or not, that if you did a real good quality story, you know, the sales would take care of themselves.
Right.
And they seem to.
Right. And you, when you got onto Spider-Man, it was a landmark issue that you first scripted with the black costume Spider-Man. Jim Shooter often, I've heard him in interviews, give you credit for saying, just let it wait a little bit. Don't take the black suit away right away, because there was a little bit of concern that people were not going to buy the book because Spider-Man was in a different suit. But it was your, you know, encouragement to say, just leave him in it for a while. How did you know that leaving him in that suit would work out in the end?
Oh, I didn't know.
Okay.
Oh, I had no idea what was going to happen. I will tell you that when word got out that we were changing Spider-Man's costume, we got such a negative reaction from the fans, from the fan press, from our own creative people. You know, we were doing three titles, and I ended up plotting, you know, most of the titles and stuff because other guys just didn't want to have anything to do with the book. They didn't want to be associated with, you know, the black costume, because this was going to be a disaster.
Hmm.
At one point, Shooter came in to me and he said, when does Spider-Man get the black costume? I said, 252. And he says, get rid of it in 253. and I said, Jim, we can't do that.
Right.
Because, you know, he's supposed to get this in Secret Wars.
Right.
It was connected to Secret Wars. And I said, he's not going to get, he's not going to get it for like eight issues into Secret Wars. You know, issue eight is when he gets it. So we have to at least keep the costume until he gets it. We can't get rid of it before he gets it.
Right.
That, you know, we'll just look like, you know, idiots. And he said, but this could kill the sales of Spider-Man. I said, Jim, you know, I think, you know, we're committed. We have to do this. Mm-hmm. You know, the die is cast. We, you know, let's just go with it and just do the best we can and just hope it all works out. And he said, no. He says, if you kill the sales of Spider-Man, he says, you know, this will be on your head. You know, you'll be fired. And I thought, well, listen, I'm only a filling guy anyway. I'm going to be fired anyway. So, all right. And you know, Tim, to his credit, said, okay, well, you know, we'll keep it for eight issues, but I want you to get rid of it. You know, that eighth issue, that, you know, eighth and ninth issue, make sure it's gone. That's definitely Jim. So, you know, everybody hated the costume. They hated the costume. You know, Secret Wars number one came out. Spider-Man 252 came out. And then after about a month or two, everybody decided they loved the costume.
Right, yeah. And a lot of people still like it to this day.
Yeah, and then at one point, Shooter came in and said, listen, are you guys planning on getting rid of it? You said, yep, getting rid of it next issue. He says, no, you got to keep it now. And I said, Jim, the issue's already, you know, already drawn and inked. And he says, well, get it back. I don't care. Get it back.
So needless to say, the sales on Spider-Man weren't affected when you took over for Roger Stern. Well, there you go. And the 252 issue is one of the most sought after Spider-Man issues now.
I guess I don't know what issues the fans like.
So when writing Spider-Man, you started off thinking you're the fill-in guy. You didn't want to ruin the character or think that you could find his voice, but you quickly did, and there was a lot of things that you brought back to the character as far as characterization, subplots, relationships that really made a difference in the mythology of Peter, specifically when it comes to his relationship with Mary Jane. Was that something that you wanted to do for the character, or was that something that they wanted, the editorial wanted you to introduce back?
Well, Juan and I were playing with Mary Jane, and we kept thinking, there's got to be more to this character. Peter Parker's, she's beautiful, but there's got to be more to her, because Peter Parker, is a smart, intelligent guy, so he's only going to hang out with smart, intelligent women, mm-hmm. no matter how beautiful they are. So we wanted to explore Mary Jane, and when we discovered that Mary Jane knew Peter Parker's secret identity, that was kind of a mistake. We plotted that issue, the issue before. Something happens, and one of a villain comes to Peter Parker's apartment. I think it was Puma,
right?
And Peter ended up throwing Mary Jane out of the apartment so he could fight Puma, and then had to come up with an explanation as to why Puma was after Peter Parker. And we worked out an explanation. We worked out the next couple of issues. And as I'm typing the plot, I get to that last scene, and to my surprise, I end up typing. Mary Jane says, "Peter, cut the stories. I know you're Spider-Man. I've always known." and I look down at that. I go, "What?" and the characters just took control of the story, and I call up Ron and I explain it to Ron, and he goes, "Wait a minute, we can't do that." And then he says, "Well, although it makes a lot of sense."
Right.
And then he started giving me some examples on why it made sense. And then the next day I went to the editor and I, told him, I gave him the plot. I said, there's a big change at the end. So I want to talk to you when you get to the end of the plot. It's not the end we discussed. And he got to the end and he goes, "Wait a minute, we can't do that." And he goes, "Although it does make a lot of sense."
Yeah.
And then we went in to talk to Shooter. And Shooter said, "What are you kidding? Mary Jane's always known? That's ridiculous." And then he sat back and he goes, "Although it does make a lot of sense." And everybody had examples on how it made sense. And they weren't all the same examples.
Right.
And Shooter looked and goes, "Yeah, this is going to shake up the whole mythos."
Yeah.
Let's do it.
Yeah, and it did, definitely. I mean, they eventually reestablished their relationship. Now, did you, but you were off the book before the eventual wedding happened between Mary Jane and Peter. Would you have gone in that direction yourself had you stayed on the book?
No. Ron and I had planned to, have Peter ask Mary Jane to marry him. Mary Jane accept, blah, blah, blah. And then when on the crucial day, she would, our plan was that she was going to leave him at the altar.
Okay.
Because we thought that fit more into the Peter Parker mythos.
Okay.
We also thought that, if Peter Parker married a beautiful woman like Mary Jane, everybody would be envying them. They did have them get married, and the marriage worked for, I was surprised and wrong about it, because I think the marriage actually worked. And I thought, okay, this was a good idea, because to me, the whole Spider-Man series is about responsibility.
Right.
Well, now Peter has an added responsibility. He has a wife.
Right.
So that's just one more responsibility on this guy's back. So I thought, okay, yeah, this works.
Yeah.
I was somewhat taken aback when Marvel decided to, erase the marriage.
Now, was it when they did it in the 2000s or when they were trying to do it during the Clone Saga era? Because they didn't erase the marriage in the Clone Saga era, but they were going to restore Peter Parker as, being single, correct?
They in the Clone Saga, the original plan was, I'm going to call him Ben Reilly.
Yep.
We didn't know his name was Ben. Ben Reilly comes back. We get the impression that Ben, is the original Spider-Man. He eventually takes over. Peter and Mary Jane go live happily ever after. Mary Jane is pregnant. They're going to go and live happily ever after. And then we have a single, Ben Reilly, although he might take on the name of Peter Parker as Spider-Man. But then came the kicker. Then something horrible would happen to Ben, and Peter would have to come back and reassume the mantle because the setup was wrong. Our Peter was always the original Peter. Mm. And now he was going to be married with a kid, an additional responsibility.
Yeah. See, I had no problem with the idea of the characters aging, getting married, having children. I know some people and some writers insist that Peter has to be, that bachelor. Having him attached kind of takes away from the things you can do with him. But you said yourself you liked how it turned out and it kind of worked. So would you have preferred to see Peter married with a child if you had continued writing him?
Well, to a certain extent, I did that series. It was called Spider-Girl.
Right.
I tend not to like characters getting married or characters having children. Because it ages the characters.
Right.
The only character that I thought it kind of worked with was Spider-Man.
Interesting.
Just because Spider-Man, the generation that hooked onto Spider-Man, kind of grew up with him. I think I was 11 or 12 when the first Spider-Man came out.
Right.
Now I'm considerably older than that. I'm glad the character didn't age like I aged because nobody wants to see a senior citizen web swing across the city. I thought since the theme of Spider-Man is responsibility, and you could write endless stories about responsibility.
Right.
I thought it kind of worked as long as you kept freezing him there. You didn't have him get a house full of kids, just stuff like that.
Right. Right.
Because I think most of our readership at this stage of the game, they're in their 30s.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Your Spider-Man is the Spider-Man that we read as kids or when we were 12. So that same experience you had reading Spider-Man, your Spider-Man became that one for us. So for me, seeing Spider-Man in a marriage was fine. I enjoyed that progression because it kept the character not in real time because comic books doesn't work that way, but there were stakes being raised or his life was changing, which was, fun to see something like that happen. If we can, I'd like to ask you some questions about your Thor run because that followed up your Spider-Man. And again, you follow Walt Simonson on Thor. You follow Roger Stern on Spider-Man, who did a classic celebrated run. And then you have the job to do the same thing now with Walter Simonson's run on Thor. How did you transition from you know, being in New York City primarily with a more of a street level character who at times, you know, fights a cosmic foe like Fire Lord or what have you. But now you're getting a character like Thor who is as cosmic as you want it to be. How do you adjust to that?
With a lot of panic and fear. what had happened was, Ron and I, after Spider-Man, our run on Spider-Man, you know, ended unhappily.
Right.
We had a crazy editor who wanted us fired so that he could write the book and blah, blah, blah. Anyway, so Ron and I hadn't worked together for, I'm going to say about a year or so. Mm-hmm. We heard that Daredevil had become open. Mm-hmm. And we started talking, and we came up with a whole bunch of ideas for doing Daredevil. So we kind of put Ron did some sketches. I put a bit of a pitch together, and I wanted to talk to the editor, Ralph Macchio. I said, Ralph, I understand that Daredevil's open, and I'd like you to consider being Ron. We'd love to do the book. And Ralph said to me, Daredevil is coming open, but I really have a problem with Thor right now. I said, well, what's your problem? He said, the book is running kind of late, and I need a fill-in. And he said, do you think you and Ron could do a Thor fill-in? And I said, yeah, I'm sure we could do a fill-in about anything. Mm-hmm. So Ron and I got together, and I don't remember which was our first fill-in, whether it was the Once in Future Thor or the Secret Wars one. And anyway, we did the Thor fill-in, and after I scripted, Ron penciled, I scripted it, and when I turned in the script, I said to Ralph, do you want to talk about Daredevil now? He says, no, I enjoy this fill-in, could you do a second one? So Ron and I did a second fill-in, And then, as we finished up that one, I said to him, so you want to talk about Daredevil now? He says, well, yeah, I want to offer you guys a book. I said, Daredevil? And he says, no, Thor. And I said, Thor? I said, we can't do Thor. We don't do cosmic. And he says, you just did two issues. but those were fill-ins, you know? They didn't affect anything. He said, no, I think you guys could do Thor. And I said, all right, let me talk to Ron. We'll see what we can come up with. And, decided to do the Celestial story. Mm-hmm. I thought, you know what? We'll start with the Celestials because, you know, that's about as cosmic as you can get.
Yeah.
And we'll find out right away we can't do it. And then we'll get fired off it. And then we'll talk about Daredevil. And so we started to, you know, we ended up doing that three-part story. And and then decided, hey, you know what? We really like Thor.
Yeah.
So we were on Thor for a long time.
I've read the two Epic collections now and the Black Galaxy Saga. I'm think 50 issues deep. That's rare that a team of two can stay on a series that long. I think you guys went a lot longer than that afterwards.
Yeah, I think we were on it for, I'm going to say, maybe 7 years.
That's
I don't know
incredible.
If that includes the Thunderstrike stuff or what.
Yeah, that's incredible.
And the only reason we left for was, to our surprise, we had always figured that the Eric Thor connection, that ended with the death of Eric.
Right.
And we had always planned that it ended with the death of Eric. And as we were coming towards the end of the run, we were, you know, planning on ending with the death of Eric. And the sales department came in, they said, how's this storyline end? And I said, well, Eric dies. And they said, no, you can't do that. Because the sales are so good on this, we want to launch Eric out into his own book. And so we want to launch him into his own book. I said, yeah. And then Ron and I were faced with, do we stay with Thor or do we go with Eric? And Eric was our guy, so we had to go with Eric.
Right.
And you know, went to Thunderstrike for 2 years.
With a character like Thor, a lot of people can compare him, I guess, to Superman. People say Superman's one of the hardest characters to write because he's too powerful and his villains aren't the greatest. With somebody like Thor, who is a god in the mythology, how do you make him continually interesting? Was that the reason of bringing the Eric Masterson character in, to kind of give him something to ground him?
Somewhat to ground him. But, you know, I've heard this thing about Superman and how hard he is to write and all that other stuff. And you know, I'm sorry, I call bullshit.
I agree. I agree.
You know, it's our job as the creative people to come up with interesting stories. And I remember talking to the editor of Superman one time saying, oh, yeah, it's hard to get a villain that can, you know, go toe-to-toe with Superman. I said, yeah, put me and Ron on the book for a year. And at the end of that year, you'll have 10 new supervillains, all of them that can take on Superman.
Yeah.
Because, you know, when we create a villain, we get to decide how strong he is, how fast he is, you know, how smart he is, all that other stuff.
Right.
And if he's going to be fighting Superman, you just make sure that he's bigger and stronger and tougher than Superman. And that's what we did with Thor. Every villain we came up with, we made sure that he was bigger, tougher, and stronger than Thor, but Thor beat him anyway.
Right. Well, you made him go up against somebody like Juggernaut. In the similar way that Roger Stern did with Spider-Man, but somebody like Juggernaut just would continue fighting. Like, it was a very compelling action comic book when he did that.
Yeah, well, we always made the villains more powerful than the heroes, because otherwise the hero is a big bully.
Yeah, exactly. So I have some listener questions for you, Tom, just before we wrap up, because I know we're going to be running out of time soon. Sam Noir, who's a local writer and comic book artist himself, he's a big fan of yours, big Spider-Man fan, but he asked what you think your legacy as Marvel editor-in-chief is a quarter century later, looking back on it.
My legacy?
Yeah. Believe it or not, you got one.
This is something I spent all of 3 seconds thinking about. When everybody asks what my biggest accomplishment is, I always say the Marvel Masterworks. Because, that took Marvel to a slightly different level. It was the first time we were producing hardcover books, and that was the very tip of our pyramid. And I'm pleased to see that they're still doing the Marvel Masterworks. Here it is, 20 some odd years later. I wish they would send me copies of the new ones, but what can you do?
Yeah, that's silly.
But I think I look back on that and I say that, that was probably my biggest accomplishment.
Yeah. And I think you were at the helm where you were really changing or part of a big change of the way the business was, especially with the direct market and all of the different titles that were being put out at the time. So it's a memorable era for comic book, the industry, and for the fans, to say the least. With that in mind, there's a lot of characters today like Miss Marvel, Spider-Gwen, Ironheart, Shuri from the current Black Panther movie. Do you think that you paved the way with a character like Spider-Girl and the run that you had on her? This is another question from Sam.
Well, I really have no idea. I have no idea. I don't really see myself as much of a trailblazer. I was just the guy trying to write the best stories I could, one issue at a time. And I think that the popularity of Siri, that goes to the popularity of the Black Panther movie, the popularity of Spider-Gwen and Carol Danvers, Ms. Marvel, goes to their current creative teams. And I don't think any of these guys were thinking about, me and Spider-Girl when they were doing their great work. So I can't take any credit for that sort of stuff, although I would love to.
That's very modest, but I would have to think that people who are writing comics today must have been influenced by characters like that, because the following for Spider-Girl, you often hear that they tried to cancel it, but the fans always wanted it back because it resonated with a certain core audience. So that in itself is a testament. If you went 100, was it over 100 issues with Spider-Girl?
I think, when you added it all up together, it's like 130.
Yeah, that doesn't happen too often. So, I mean, you could be modest, but I would say you're a trailblazer in a lot of ways for having that good book that no matter what the sales were, people wanted it, and they kept putting it out there for them.
Well, the sales were a lot better than people remember it.
Right, right.
In the direct market, sales only go down.
Yes.
Over a period of time, it's always a downward slant.
Right.
So at Marvel, they would look at a title and they'd say, well, look, the sales are here at this level. In 6 or 12 issues, you're going to be underwater, so we're going to have to cancel you.
Right.
And that's when they would plan to cancel Spider-Girl, except Spider-Girl was the exception that proved the rule. Our sales never went down. If anything, they stayed in a straight line or they went up.
Right.
They never went down. And that's why they, kept having to uncancel us.
What do you think it was about that character that resonated with people? Because there's already, four or five Spider-Man titles on the shelf any given month. What was it about Spider-Girl that, for you, Ron, Pat Olive, that you were just getting it right, hitting home runs with it?
I think Spider-Girl was just a good old-fashioned title where you had a likable character. You had a lot of melodrama. You had a lot of subplots and supporting cast. And you had a whole world built around. So the readers cared about a whole bunch of different characters. They cared about Spider-Girl. They cared about DeVita. They cared about Courtney. They cared about, all of the individual characters, because each of these characters we treated like real people. And, they had their own stories. So everybody wanted to know what was going to happen next to this one, to that one. We basically had a grand soap opera going on there.
Right. Good old-fashioned, like you said, good old-fashioned comic books.
Yeah. And these days, a lot of comic books don't have subplots or supporting casts.
Right.
People in costume only talk to other people in costume. So, the readers aren't getting that soap opera experience as much as they used to get.
Yes.
And I believe in that for, kind of any kind of fiction that you're doing. Look at any successful character-oriented television show.
Yeah.
It's the supporting cast and the subplots that keep us coming back, week after week.
Yes. I experienced that in reading your Thor run, because I knew that this Eric Masterson's character would appear eventually, but the subplot with him and his son became something that you always come back to. Oh yeah, that's you know, Thor's got to stop fighting because he's got to go and deal with this issue. For me, that became more important sometimes than just the cosmic issue that could be destroying the city. I was more concerned about Eric Masterson and Kevin. So yeah, you're right. That subplot is what keeps you attached to the title. It's true.
Yeah, well, it's writing 101.
Right. And nowadays, now that I think about it, a lot of the books that I read on the shelf now that are it's a storyline, the 6-issue storyline, and it's that pretty much issue. That storyline is all that you're getting. You're not getting those other things happening elsewhere. Yeah, I enjoy being able to go back into those epic collections and reading comics the way they once were. One last question comes from Adam Chapman of the Comic Shenanigans podcast. He says he first started reading or regularly buying ASM with issue 418, which was the first post-Clone Saga issue of Amazing. And during your run, you introduced the Hand spinoff, True Believers, Black Tarantula, many more. You resurrected Dr. Octopus, gave Electro a makeover and power upgrade. So in your bringing back of Dr. Octopus, who was a casualty, an early casualty of the Clone Saga, when you were still editor-in-chief, what was your impetus to want to bring him back? Was it something that bothered you to have him missing, or did you just think this was a character that needed to be put back into the mythology or the Rogues Gallery?
I thought it was a mistake to kill him off in the first place, even though my issue was the issue where it happened. I think it is always a foolish thing to kill off a character, because comic book deaths never take.
right.
And readers are a cowardly and superstitious lot, and they want their characters back.
Right.
So I think it's always a foolish thing. I think a lot of times whenever a bad writer takes over a book and introduces a brand new villain, he always wants that villain to kill some other established villain to show how tough he is. Right. And I think, that all that does is prove how lame your new character is and how bad a writer you are. If you can't figure out a way to make your character look scary other than killing off an established character, then you have no business, writing a comic book. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody in specific. I'm just talking about this in general.
Right.
And I thought that when we got together, we were going to introduce Kane, and everybody in the Spider group voted that Kane should kill off Dr. Octopus. I objected. I argued. I was not editor-in-chief at the time, so I just had to go along with it, and it happened in my issue. When I did the plot, the first time I did the plot, the editor looked and he said, "I can see 3 ways that you can reverse this." And I thought, oh, man, I got to be more subtle. So I redid the plot, gave it to him, and he says, I'm sure you got at least one way. I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Get it out." So I had to keep redoing the end of the plot until I, convinced him that there was no way to bring Dr. Octopus back, but I still had a way, and I brought him back as soon as I...
Yeah, and I think that's the mark of the way that you brought him back. You didn't invalidate his death, but you did it in a way that it worked with the continuity. You didn't ignore it. So it wasn't a hackneyed way of just bringing back this character. I have to ask, in regards to you wrote Amazing Spider-Man, where it was just you and Ron on that book. But then later on, when you were on the Clone Saga, you had 4 or 5 writers and teams that you had to kind of pass the baton to. What was that experience like for you to be writing in that type of style of a monthly ongoing, where you had to think about what the other guy was doing or what he was going to do next?
Well, you had to keep reading everything that everybody else was doing. Mm-hmm. That was a whole different experience. And we used to meet once a month where we would work everything out. And those editorial meetings, you know, some of the most fun I ever had as a comic book writer. I got to work with some great guys, you know, Howard Mackey, Todd DeZego, Terry Cavanaugh, you know, the great Mark Donatis, you know, the editors with Danny Fingroth, Bob Budiansky, you know, we were having a fabulous time. Everybody's throwing in ideas. At one point, Mark would always do part one. I would always do part four of the four-part story, so I got to wrap everything up. And I thought I thought I was good at the wrap-up. And you know, we just had a blast.
That's great. So, having been an editor, editor-in-chief, having written Spider-Man so much, do you have a personal run of Spider-Man that you weren't a part of that is your favorite, or a writer who was your favorite, other than Stan Lee and Steve Ditko, because I think that's everybody's. Do you have a favorite?
You know, my two favorites, aside from Stan, you know, his run with Steve is his run with anybody. Mm-hmm. You know, my two favorite Spider-Man writers were, you know, Roger Stern, whose stuff I, on the one hand, I love his stuff. On the other hand, I hate him because no matter what I did, his was better. So that bum.
Yeah.
And Mark Donatis.
Yeah.
You know, those are my guys in terms of reading Spider-Man stuff.
Mm. And I guess it's timely to mention it, but did you ever get a chance to meet Steve Ditko? And if you did, what was your interaction like with him, having him just passed and, you know, being the legendary Spider-Man creator, co-creator?
Well, I met Steve Ditko. Steve and I worked together on Machine Man.
Oh, okay.
For, I guess about six issues. And when I was an editor, I would have a coffee pot in my office. And Steve would stop by and have a cup of coffee or have a donut, and we would chit-chat about all sorts of things, except, you know, comics. I don't know why. We never got around to talking about comics. So I got to know Steve somewhat. I think, you know, a great person, a very personable guy, a very sweet guy, a very, you know, dependable, just a really nice guy.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard that he's some people have called him a recluse. I never saw that, or antisocial. I never saw that aspect of him. But I, you know, a total professional and just a really great guy.
Where would you hold him in the pantheon of comic book artists?
Oh, well, definitely one of the greats. I, you know, you know, there are certain guys, you know, Ditko, you know, Kirby, Romita, Kubert, Eisner,
mm-hmm.
Jack Cole, Bob Powell, you know, certain guys that are just on a whole other level from everybody else.
Yeah.
And you know, please don't ask me to, you know, rate those guys.
No, I never would. No, I never would.
Yeah, how can you?
No, you can't.
But you know, he is in the pantheon of the great.
Yeah, definitely. Well, with a character as enduring as Spider-Man, I you know, Steve Ditko created all of those villains, the designs, the everything about him that we visually connect with that character. So that says a lot. Thank you so much for giving me as much of your time as you did. I know we went a little bit over, but I really, really enjoyed this conversation. I hope it wasn't too painful and that you can come on again, because I still have a lot of other questions I didn't get around to asking.
I appreciate it. I had a really good time. I think my days in comics are over. While I still do the very occasional job, I can't see myself at this stage of my life, you know, doing a monthly comic book ever again.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't see any editor wanting me to do a monthly comic book ever again. But I had a blast when I was in the industry. I thought it was just a terrific time. I got to work with some fabulous people, and I still love the medium. I still love the characters, and I appreciate you guys remembering an old fart like me. So thank you very much.
Well, you're a lot of people's favorite writer. So if ever you doubt your legacy, just remember a lot of kids grew up that are my age now who you were their Spider-Man, you were their Thor writer. So thank you for all the things that you gave us to enjoy growing up.
All right. You take it easy, sir.
You take it easy.